Welcome to the podcast series from the 9th EMN Educational Seminar on Migration 2023, entitled Protection of Migrants in Vulnerable Situations, organized by the European Migration Network in Slovakia. You are listening to the lecture on global estimates and data sets on human trafficking and examples of effective assistance to the victims by Heather Komenda, Senior Regional Thematic Specialist for Protection at the International Organization for Migration Regional Office in Vienna. Heather is a migrant protection professional with 20 years of experience in protection and assistance. She has extensive experience in supporting development of anti-trafficking frameworks and structures and in providing technical assistance to partners in government, civil society, and law enforcement. Enjoy the lecture.
Thank you. You can hear me? Fantastic. Great. So I'm super excited to have the after-lunch session on the third day to talk about numbers and research. So this is going to go amazing, I'm sure of it. Okay, so what I would like to do with you over the next hour or so, well, first, I'll quickly introduce IOM. I see our logos all over the place, so I don't think I need to do too much of it. But what I think is the key point here is that IOM has a very large footprint in direct assistance and protection services for victims of trafficking. It is one of our largest area of work, and it is work that we do all over the world. So we do have, I think, good insight into how trafficking dynamics operate and the impact it has on victims of trafficking, and as we'll get to, how best to address these. Now, I need to make the case to you for why you should be very excited to learn about data. And you should be. We often talk about evidence-based policies, about doing the best work, about being the most effective. And we know this from our day-to-day, that the way we measure this, the way that we improve, is we look at the impact we are having, and we need data to understand trafficking dynamics, who traffickers are. We use the terms already today, vulnerability to trafficking, and well, in theory, anybody is vulnerable to trafficking. In reality, there are different vulnerabilities, and it impacts people differently. But we can't just guess this based on assumptions. We do need to pay attention to the data and research and invest in data and research to understand how do we best provide assistance. Where should we spend our money? Where should we invest our research? Where is our work going to have the most impact? By targeting groups who need to be most targeted by various interventions, be they protection, or ideally, before trafficking and exploitation has occurred, by prevention. What kinds of prevention efforts are more efficient? How and where do perpetrators operate? What policy and program changes should be advocated for? And what are the trends that we are seeing in trafficking? Can I ask for a show of hands if anybody is active in law enforcement? Any police officers, immigration officers, labor officers? So no frontline law enforcement, okay? What about show of hands who's from civil society, who's interacting regularly with victims of trafficking? Good, this is great. Then you're gonna really love this data because it really leans into law enforcement and social protection data. But what I will do is give you an overview of key initiatives in data, important data sets, who's researchers? Okay, good, we've got three of you. And estimates, just to kind of get the lay of the land when it comes to what is known about trafficking in persons and how it is known. Then I will move on to protection and assistance. So when it comes to, actually, if you guys were fast, then you can answer the questions, but I'll quiz you. Where does data come from when it comes to trafficking in persons? Reported victims, reported by whom? By the authorities, such as, love it, national rapporteurs, who get their data from law enforcement and usually police, NGOs, civil society. These are really the key sources of data. And if we think about where this comes from, the actual locus of the data, case data comes from trafficked persons themselves. So this is an incredibly powerful. I really appreciated this morning's speaker who focused on the experience of victims of trafficking. Case data is when victims tell their stories. It can be very complicated. There's a lot of structuring that goes into how they're allowed to tell their stories, how their stories are captured, how that information is used. But I'm quite passionate about this because this is when they get to tell us, anti-trafficking practitioners, their experience and their needs. Administrative data is another very, very important source. And this refers to data that is gathered by officialdom in the performance of their functions. So when labor officers do their inspections and they fill in certain sheets, when police conduct investigations and somehow document it and ideally report it to the counter-trafficking unit, when prosecutors open up and proceed with trafficking prosecutions, also migration statistics, census, all of these different data collection efforts that the state undertakes on an ongoing basis. And of course, one-off or long-term research efforts specifically investigating trafficking in persons. Now, case data. This refers to the information gathered directly from the affected persons. So trafficked persons or potential or presumed victims of trafficking. These are the two key sources of case data. This is caseworkers. And from those of us who are maybe not familiar with social work or that practice, I will speak about case management at some length. But this is the process of care. When somebody with a mandated role provides care to potential or actual victims of trafficking. Or hotlines. And hotlines have been around in the anti-trafficking world for a long time, but I think they've become perhaps more important and more capacitated. Often hotline operators are the first point of contact for victims of trafficking. They're the first ones with the possibility of doing a preliminary identification, and they provide a lot of referral information for victims of trafficking. So, of course, case data contains rich and detailed information on the trafficked persons and their experiences. And historically, this has been gathered and used according to each organization's own internal procedures. So basically, there's a scenario where, say, a victim of trafficking shows up at an NGO, is identified, receives assistance, and from the protection side of things, all is well. Usually the caseworker would then sit and record their case data somewhere. That is already a pretty big assumption because many times these basic procedures aren't in place. But historically what has happened is that that data then stays locked in that building or in that computer, and nobody else knows anything about it. Now, there are very significant data protection issues, and to some extent, well, that is a primary consideration, but there's procedures that can be put in place to protect identifying information. Because the issue then is we have service providers with massive amounts of data, but it's not comparable, it's not available to researchers, so it's not doing the work that it could be doing to contribute to anti-trafficking efforts. Now, we are in this space because globally, IOM is the largest provider of direct assistance services to victims of trafficking, either directly through our programs or through our network of partners in civil society. So we assist between 7,000 and 8,000 victims every year. And when we are involved in protection and assistance activities, we do gather bio data and data on the trafficking experience. We put this into our own data set. It's very protected, but it's really quite a powerful research tool for researchers, policymakers, etc. Now, our database is first and foremost a case management system. So it is a system that helps us do our work in providing protection and assistance services to victims of trafficking. It is focused on the individual level. And I think it is very important to note, it's big, that's great, but there's many, many limitations. First and foremost is the people that are in our data set are victims of trafficking who have come to the attention of IOM. And there's a lot of factors that structure that. Are we present in the country? If not, we have no data. Doesn't mean that trafficking isn't happening. It means that it's not showing up in this large database. We also have a skewed perspective on trafficking, which we acknowledge, because it's more frequent for cases to be referred to us when they have an international element. So there's probably an overrepresentation of internationally trafficked persons, and that's for a very practical reason. Very often, local NGOs don't have the money or the expertise to buy an international travel ticket. So they could come to IOM, great, we are here for that, but then it skews our data. And perhaps most critically, we know very well that the vast majority of victims of trafficking are not identified. So this represents the population of trafficked persons who have come to the attention of the protection and assistance space, which is also likely very different than the general population. So the data we have, specific location data. Where were you trafficked from? Where were you trafficked to? For what types of work? What sectors? Sectors are a very hot issue right now because it is becoming more and more known that certain sectors in certain locations are much more likely to have victims of trafficking in them. Types of exploitation, how they entered into the trafficking process, which we think isn't that important information. If we know in a particular location that, for example, recruiters are going to towns and offering education to 16 to 18-year-olds, but this is in fact a lure for trafficking, we can obviously quite quickly tweak our programming and our prevention efforts to address specific rather than general risks. And this is very important because often when we look at prevention efforts, they are wide-ranging, kind of aimed at population level, often focused on general awareness, which is useful. I think that is a necessary element, but it's not sufficient often for addressing the real information needs of specific groups based on real present risks. Means of exit from the trafficking process. Were they rescued? And heavy quotations on that. Were they able to remove themselves? Was it through a law enforcement action? Was it through members of the community? Was it by their family, etc.? Means by which victims are controlled, biodata of the victim, and the assistance activities provided. So when we think now that we have about 100,000 case records, there's a lot of research that can be done with that information. But we have been aware that these limitations that I had just mentioned needed to be overcome. So we did want to take this learning experience and broaden it out. So together with partners, we established the CTDC, which is the Counter Trafficking Data Collaborative. And it is the first and biggest global data hub on human trafficking. And what we aim to do and are doing is bringing in case data from other organizations. So this is a way to build and grow the data set, also overcome some of the limitations for gathering data only from IOM. So we can get broader coverage, more countries, different types of trafficked persons, etc. So this started, I think, about 10 years ago with IOM and Polaris. Polaris is a hotline, in the US, and then also Liberty Shared, which was a consortium of NGOs in Southeast Asia. But now we also have A21, and here's at present where the records are coming from. So 71,000 from IOM, almost 70 from Polaris, 16,000 from Liberty Shared, and approaching 1,000 for A21. Now, it sounds very nice. We get everybody together, we have hugs, and we all share our data. Obviously, it is much more complicated than that. So merging data sets is not easy. Some just examples. Polaris data is based on case records from phone calls, which is pretty different than case data gathered from victim records, face-to-face, ongoing interaction. There's different definitions used. So Polaris is a US actor, so their definitions are in line with their TVPA, their legislation on anti-trafficking. IOM uses the Palermo Protocol-based definition. Comes through different ways. There is more of a focus on reporting to law enforcement in Polaris than there is in IOM, which tends to be more active in the migration management sphere, etc. So already just the data sets reflect the means of operation. I'm going to give some examples before I move on to how we're dealing with this. So I am just going to flip through some examples very briefly. If you are interested in this, please do check out the website. I actually still find it quite fascinating. But here we have, I just pulled these the other day just for illustration purposes. But with all of the cases in this data set, we see that 53% are trafficked for the purposes of labor exploitation, 43% for sexual exploitation, and only 4% for other forms of exploitation. Again, this is not representative of the universe of trafficked persons, but it's still good information. In terms of gender, 66% female, which tracks with global estimates, but is actually lower than many others because of the significant involvement of trafficking for the purposes of labor exploitation, which tends to, in our data set, affect all genders, well, male and female, roughly equally, as opposed to sexual exploitation, which skews heavily female. In our global data set, there's region of origin, adults and children, etc. So I pulled some European stats, and 92% of the identified victims of trafficking in our data set are of European origins. Age, distribution, and here is just some of the different things you can look at. You can get visualizations for age, exploitation, gender, global data set analysis, etc. It's super interesting. You can generate maps. So that's just a commercial for CTDC. But in the process of building this with some key partners, there was also a realization that case data standards vary tremendously. Very often, there's small organizations that develop their own procedures for data collection and handling, usually within a reasonable set of parameters on data protection, etc. But still, people are doing it differently, different forms, different indicators, different methods, etc. So when we want to build out the data set, we're getting all different kinds of data. So the human trafficking case data standards, these are brand new, hot ticket items. It was released on GitHub, which is a platform I had to learn just for this presentation. A web platform, open, free, you can all download the stuff. And what it does is it provides tools to assisting organizations to sharpen up, to improve their data collection so that they can contribute to the CTDC. So we would expect to see a lot of growth in the CTDC as uptake of this improves, but it is still very, very new. So it is a global reference for collecting and recording data related to human trafficking cases. It enables organizations worldwide to collect and potentially share information consistently. So it does have a potentially transformative impact. And it's quite simple. It uses spreadsheets. It uses Excel. It keeps it really nice and simple so that it's got a light impact on the organization. And it's also very helpful to them because it gives them a ready-made package. So people don't have to invest basically reinventing the wheel over and over in 200 different countries with 500 different NGOs. Good. So if you are involved in case data collection, this would be of interest to you. Reach out to us. We do a lot of training. There's lots of tools, but I'll move along. Now, Those standards are related to case data, but there's also standards related to administrative data. And these aren't even released yet, so you're really getting the hot stuff. So this is an initiative between IOM and UNODC. So I can speak for IOM, but I'll also do a little commercial for UNODC, our good colleagues in the UN system. So as I'm sure you all know, they regularly do a global report on trafficking in persons. And this draws, their report draws on administrative data, specifically law enforcement data. So what's very nice is we have IOM and its partners with case data, and UNODC and national governments with law enforcement data, which starts to give a pretty good picture overall of the trafficking scenarios, if used well, etc. But it faces the same challenges. States are not born with full data management capacities, especially for newer or emerging issues. So these standards address the same problems. Data are rarely standardized or comparable across institutions or states. IOM is exactly that. She asked who was the lead. We have the largest data set on case data, so from the individual victims of trafficking themselves, and UNODC's mandate is the involvement with law enforcement. So they are the lead on gathering and collating law enforcement data and doing the analysis. So standardization across institutions, for those who work in government or any complex organization, just think about how easy it is to get statistics from your colleagues in other divisions. Yes. So just think on that. Think on that on a rarely, or a fairly, like it's not new as we learned this morning, but it's a newer area of work for data and statistics. So even nationally, I could promise you, I can't even think of a very good example where nationally the institutions of government are sharing information well, especially when often the sources of data are from law enforcement, police, immigration, which tend to securitize data for valid operational reasons, but then civil society, NGOs, service providers who heavily protect data for valid reasons, they can't even, in a municipality, share this very well to understand the trends. So we just think layer after layer after layer, this becomes more complicated and it compounds to the point that we don't really have good statistics. I mean, we just don't. We know this, and this is some of the reasons why. So data sets are diverse, dispersed, disconnected. You know all of this. Often there is a lacking capacity to manage this data. Data and information, I mean, this is just exploding. And many practitioners like myself, when we start talking about statistical modeling, I mean, this is not my strength. And like I've mentioned, data are often sensitive, so people kind of tend towards protecting it. So what do these global standards do? They provide common definitions for the purposes of data collection. They provide reference metadata, build a data model. They provide guidance and best practice on data privacy, as well as on data management. So this creates the environment of standards that administrative data can adhere to. I think that's fairly clear, but it is in line with the International Classification of Crime for Statistical Purposes, designed to integrate data, can be referenced, applicable worldwide, and just basically, in a nutshell, sets the standards for data governance on trafficking in persons. Now, then we start to see that this data environment is quite complex, and there's different ways of looking at it. So the law enforcement data focuses on the perpetrator, the trafficker. The case data focuses on the victim. Then we have an event of trafficking, sometimes called the trafficking case, which I find gets very confusing with case data. But then you also have the reporting entity, who was doing the identification and who was reporting it. So it is a complicated scenario trying to get all this data together. I'll just flip through this quickly. Long story short, for the statisticians amongst us who wish to revolutionize data management in their governments, there's a lot of materials and assistance available for you to do so. Get in touch. in the presentation. There's links that you can follow, but then this is very nice to have standards. It's very nice to have data. What are we actually doing with it? And I think the happy news is quite a lot. So with this data, researchers can do a lot of large end studies without engaging in primary data collection, because it's very common to do one-off research studies, and I wouldn't necessarily critique them. Feel free to do so from the floor. But they tend to be expensive and of short validity, because we know very well that once something is known about a trafficking trend and once law enforcement acts against that, traffickers change their MO, so the information we have is outdated within a year. And then you think, what, you're going to do a research project every year? It obviously makes more sense to invest in information management systems than one-off research. That being said, with these large data sets, a lot is being learned. And I will speak a bit more about the global estimates, because they're probably the most important when it comes to understanding global trafficking data. But I really quite like this report that was done by the World Bank, which used the CTDC data set to look at vulnerability factors. And IOM has developed a determinants of migrant vulnerability model that looks at risk and protection factors at various levels: individual, household, community, and structural. That's all I'll say about it, although I'd love to talk about it for 4 hours. I think it's valuable because it makes us broaden out our horizons so that we understand that individuals are not trafficked due to individual deficits. There are individual risk factors, but in the absence of traffickers, in the absence of facilitating factors, they will not experience trafficking. So we have to think of the individuals as embedded in their families, in their communities, and in their societies. And what this piece of research did is it looked at the structural level. So it compared exogenous shocks, specifically economic shocks, to a country and regressed it against trafficking statistics. Very fancy. But it did show that these structural factors are, in fact, associated. Economic shocks increases the risk of trafficking in that country. So we are starting to paint the picture that we don't just go and say, don't be trafficked to individuals. Protect yourself. Learn about trafficking. We can start to say we need to start building more just and equitable and resilient societies, which will be broadly protective of a range of issues, including trafficking. Briefly, I will talk about the global estimates of modern slavery. We had the the conceptual discussion about modern slavery this morning. So just to focus on the fact that this looks at forced labor and forced marriage, and it was released in 2022. I think there was an update earlier in the year, but the 2022 publication is currently, I think, the standard. So prior to this, ILO had global estimates of forced labor, and Walk Free had global estimates of modern slavery together with IOM and ILO. They use this typology of modern slavery with the following definitions: forced labor, all worker services extracted from any person under the menace of any penalty, etc. Forced marriage, again, we've covered this conceptually. So they base their estimates off multiple data sources, because, as I think is clear, no one single source of information is sufficient to paint a good picture. So for forced labor, they were looking at household surveys and self-reports. On forced commercial sexual exploitation, they relied on the CTDC. Same for forced labor of children, and for state-imposed forced labor. This is reports from ILO supervisory bodies. And just briefly, here are some of the statistics. So there are nearly 50 million people in modern slavery on any given day. And it breaks down using this model and their typology: over 27 million in forced labor and 22 million in forced marriage. There is an increase in recent years from an estimated 40 million to an estimated 50 million. There's large variations by sex, age, region, and income grouping. Again, their website has all of these details. Okay, the 27 enforced labor. The majority is imposed by private actors. They also have a section looking at state-imposed forced labor. Asia-Pacific region has the highest number of people in forced labor, and the Arab states the highest prevalence, according to their methods. Forced labor is at least as much a problem in rich countries as it is in poor ones. More than half of all forced labor occurs in either upper middle or high income countries, etc. So these are, again, just some commercials for that estimate as well. Okay, with that, I've covered data and nobody is yet sleeping, which is amazing. Any questions on that before I discuss effective assistance for trafficked persons? Good. It's a very different topic, and I have 10 minutes? Good. Okay, you're lucky that they have timekeepers, because this is now where I really wake up, because this is my passion and my specialty. I have done this in only 4 slides, so don't worry, we'll get there. Okay, these are what I have found the most useful tools for thinking about effective assistance to victims of trafficking. No one is necessarily more important than the other, but I do think if we have these 4 parameters, we do know quite a bit about effective assistance. So typically we see immediate, intermediate, and longer-term needs. For effective resolution of a situation, for a sustainable solution, all of them are important. I find that these are often the easiest to deliver, the most clear needs, and it just gets progressively harder, I think. But immediate needs are what we would expect. So I'll draw from some case histories for situations that I have worked on. So when I was in Southeast Asia, this trend remains, but it was in the early days of recognizing that men were being trafficked for forced labor on fishing vessels. So I was literally working with men who had jumped from boats and swam to shore. So they had nothing, no place to sleep that night, malnourished, dirty, torn clothes, sometimes with urgent medical needs. And in that case, family unity was usually not an issue. But these are the hot issues that service providers have to deal with on day one. And they are basic human needs. It varies in severity, but sometimes you have trafficked persons who have zero capacity, no money, no friends, no language, no resources. And we really have to think about comprehensive, immediate care for stabilization. In the longer term, once those needs are met, which is often not easy, there's often not a lot of money hanging around to put people up in hotel rooms for weeks while they get medical care. Just another case I worked on, a case where a woman had leapt from a 4th-floor building to escape her traffickers. That was the only way she could get away, and she had compound fractures all through her legs, which required months and thousands of dollars for treatment. So these can be very serious situations. So once that is addressed, then we have the intermediate term, where we can start planning for longer-term recovery. So here we start thinking, we shift from kind of emergency mode to, okay, I have to start thinking about what it's going to look like, or we have to start working towards where you want to be in 5 years' time, in 20 years' time. And that means putting in place interventions. We need to think through, what are your vulnerability factors? I want to be very clear that this is not a victim blaming. What have you done wrong to get yourself into this scenario at all? But it is to understand why this person was trafficked. Why are they here now? I worked a case with a simple kidnap. Simple kidnap, kid grabbed off the street. Obviously, that kid didn't do anything wrong to be kidnapped. But there was a culture of impunity where people felt emboldened to just snatch kids off the street. So we think through how to mitigate and respond to those factors of vulnerability. And often this involves education and livelihoods. So for children, usually access to education, we know this. This is not specific to trafficking. This is a fundamental building block for a successful life. Livelihoods or income generation, so some means of self-sustaining. And in my experience, these are the two truly hot issues. But we also have major concerns with family counseling and reintegration, life skills, and mental health and psychosocial support. These are the interventions that set us up for success over the longer term recovery. And then we have to think through sustainable solutions for recovery. Social integration or reintegration, because stigma and lack of social integration have profound psychosocial impacts. Another case I am aware of, when I was in East Africa, a partner told us about this. They were managing the case. A young woman from a very traditional community and family was trafficked to Europe for sexual exploitation. She rescued herself. She got help. So just think about the emotional resources she needed to do that. She returned home and her family let her physically into the house, but rejected her as a human being. So she was profoundly stigmatized. She was deeply shamed. She was not reaccepted by her family and her community. And she went to her bedroom and she died. She didn't kill herself, but she stopped eating. She stopped talking. The family didn't intervene. And eventually she just died and she was 20 years old. So this stigma and social reintegration is not an afterthought. It's massive. That's obviously an extreme. But then we think about alcoholism, substance misuse, harmful behaviors that really sabotage somebody's... We don't want people to just survive. We want them to thrive. And without integration, it's likely not going to happen. Caring for physical and mental health. So it's very well established that trafficking has health impacts. Sometimes they are relatively minor, like sleep disturbances. But if there's any fellow insomniacs in the room, sleep disturbances are not, in fact, minor. But all the way through to very complicated mental health and physical health impacts of their trafficking experience. Stable housing and income generation, massively important. Everybody needs a safe place to live. And there's more and more research showing that homelessness is very, very associated. It's a strong association, big indicator for trafficking. Income generation and social assistance. Not everybody is going to have the capacity to earn money to support themselves. This is just the reality. If we have complex trauma, substance abuse, perhaps criminal history, sometimes the most effective thing to do is to refer an individual into a social assistance program. So immediate, intermediate, longer term. Then, this is the case management model. This one slide I will try to talk about for only 5 minutes, but really we should get a master's of social work to understand all of the dynamics. But in brief, one thing I think that is happening is the anti-trafficking sector is looking to social work. Social work has been around since Durkheim. It's not a new thing, but often we've been doing anti-trafficking interventions and not coding it or not understanding it as social work. And now I think it's a lot more explicit, and we're learning a lot of best practice and knowledge from social work. So the social work case cycle or case management cycle starts with identification. So this is simply when a victim of trafficking is identified. This is not simple. Who does the identification? How is it somebody's opinion, or is there tools and standards? Are the people doing the identification trained? Should they be alone in a room with a victim of trafficking? Are there regulations to allow them to talk to, say, a child victim of trafficking? Are there enough female police officers because internationally trafficked women for the purposes of sexual exploitation are probably not going to talk very easily to male police officers, etc. This in itself is massive, but it's step one. Once a victim of trafficking has been identified, we move into the assessment phase. So the purpose here usually, and I am simplifying, and it sounds like a blunt force instrument, but it's basically, are you eligible for services? And I think it's important for us in social protection to understand our gatekeeping function here. There has been some research that shows that social service providers over-identify victims of trafficking. And I know from personal experience that we have the impulse to do so because protection actors want to get people in to the services. If they identify somebody who requires some form of assistance, the dynamic there is to identify, which is often very different than law enforcement. But, so at identification, there is a process of basically in or out. And ideally, if somebody is not eligible for services, which in many anti-trafficking programs means they're not victims of trafficking, the idea is to refer them to appropriate service providers. Fine. Assuming that they have been identified as a victim of trafficking and they are eligible for your program, you would do an intake, which is simply, or it should be, a process where you both agree, here are the services available to you. Would you like these services? Here is what I can provide, etc. And then you move into the process of assessing more deeply. Identification, I have done it in as little as 5 minutes. It's not very comprehensive, but sometimes it's all you need. Assessment is not like a sit down for 4 hours and let's talk about it. This is an ongoing process where you start to gather more information about the individual and what they want. What is their family background? What are their factors of vulnerability? What are the services that they want, that they need, that are available? And once you have a good understanding, and at this stage already, we do want to think about sustainable solutions, but we move into the planning phase, where we start identifying the services available and putting in place a case plan, moving towards certain objectives. And it is quite important to think through, what do we wish to achieve? And usually when it comes to service provision for victims of trafficking, we want to see sustainable recovery, this longer-term process. Case plan implementation is providing the services or referring out to the services that are required and monitoring that process, following up, making sure the objectives are being reached, and then moving on to case closure. Again, we should have talked about this for at least a week, but that's a very quick overview of the social work approach to case management for victims of trafficking, because very often they have complex and longer term needs. Case management is not the right service for all situations. Sometimes people actually only need one or two services. But when we think in general what victims of trafficking require, they do often need case management, and I've listed it as a specific service because it is. Some organizations provide case management, some don't. Then they have their basic needs, which are very often their immediate needs, but this is a different way of thinking about it. These are the things that the body needs to survive: shelter, nutrition, clothes, personal care items, healthcare, and then rights. And I think this is also critically important. Knowledge about their rights, counseling on their rights, understanding that they have rights to family reunification and reintegration, legal assistance to help them understand, articulate, and pursue those rights. Support. And this is information that I think practitioners have gleaned from their own experience. I know that I'm frequently requested to support victims of trafficking through difficult processes, but consultation with victims themselves have identified this. We work with bureaucracy all day long. Like, nobody's scared. A police officer comes up to me, I don't break a sweat. I've been dealing with law enforcement for 30 years. But for your average citizen who hasn't been trafficked, police can be scary in some situations, in some countries. And now if you think a victim of trafficking who's been threatened with police, I have worked cases where immigration actually moonlighted as security for the brothel in the evening. I had a client who was raped by immigration crossing the border. I mean, they don't want to interact with officialdom, and sometimes they have to. So support in moving through the criminal justice system, if they're involved in that, and honestly, just support sometimes with appointments. We know the psychosocial impacts of trauma can make remembering appointment times and dates difficult. Transportation in low-resource environments is a huge issue. So really being, I don't want to say a partner to them, because there's always a professional element as well, but being next to them as they navigate these really often complex, long-term, and complicated procedures. Then, of course, recovery, building up those skills and capacities to help them thrive, and working towards sustainable solutions. And I will point out here that when it comes to internationally trafficked persons, we almost always have to think about regularization of their migration status. So data and research is also very clear that trafficking in persons disproportionately impacts migrants, particularly irregular migrants. And migrants who are in irregular status will remain vulnerable in almost all cases to some degree until their status is regularized. And there's really only three options. Local integration, so they might be given a recovery visa or pathways to longer term rights to stay. Moving onward, which is very difficult, and there's very few regular migration pathways, or return and reintegration. Lastly, anybody working with victims of trafficking should do so in compliance with these principles, which I think we're all familiar with. I won't go through them in too much detail, but even the first one, do no harm, is a big one. Because I've often seen people really want to intervene. When I was new, I have done some things that I would not do now, where I've been called upon to intervene where I didn't have resources. So if you go and respond and do an interview, actually, I'll give an example of a case I had nothing to do with, but in one country, there was a very large international community presence, and there was a report that a girl, quite a young girl, had been a victim of a sexual assault, and somebody called me up to see if I wanted to interview her. And I was like, why would I want to interview her? And they're like, well, everybody else did. I'm like, what do you, looks of horror, 7 agencies interviewed this girl. It's disgusting. So before we respond, we really have to think through, are we bringing something to the table, or are we just going to re-traumatize and further harm this person? What I learned in that context is that usually when it came to children, I said no, because we had child protection actors and we had NGOs that were better. They were better placed. So then I would start to provide support to the NGO, saying, oh, here's what you need to know about trafficking. Here's what I know. Here's what you can do. But never seeing the victims themselves, because I didn't have anything unique to offer them directly. Consent, an individual's trafficking experience is their experience. So from a social work perspective, interviews are based on consent. Delivery of services is based on consent. Sharing data about them is based on consent. It's a principle, but it's also so important for empowerment, because trafficked persons have had the rights to their own mind, body, lives systematically stripped from them. So when you start giving them the power back, and I don't even like that phrase, but treating them as though they do have power and agency, this is profoundly transformative also. Individualized, basically no cookie cutter approaches. We understand the individual, their individual scenario, and come up with tailored individual responses. Of course, the famous example is programs that give every woman a sewing machine. This is not sustainable. It's not appropriate. Self-determination and participation, migrant-centered, gender-responsive, a huge issue because trafficking is so deeply gendered, child-sensitive, rights-based, non-discriminatory, and respecting confidentiality, privacy, and data protection. And I will stop talking.
This lecture was part of the 9th EMN Educational Seminar on Migration, entitled Protection of Migrants in Vulnerable Situations. The seminar is organized by the International Organization for Migration Slovakia as the coordinator of the Slovak EMN National Contact Point. This activity is funded by the European Union and co-funded by the Ministry of Interior of the Slovak Republic. Thank you for listening.